Well, do take a seat and turn back in your Bible to 2 Corinthians and chapter 12, page 819, if you're using one of the church Bibles. And as you do so, I wonder if you've ever had that experience or been in the presence of someone who considers themselves to be a real expert. You know the kind of person I mean, someone that just merrily sounds off on whatever subject it is that happens to catch their eye or catch their fancy. And they've were quite happy to share the finer points of such and such, and what they believe and think of so and so's opinion, and believe people that people should bow to their wisdom on this particular subject because they just really know. And then all of a sudden, a real expert walks in, and all of the shared opinion falls silent, and suddenly everyone's opinion of them drops. Because real expertise is in the room. And the so-called appointed experts, self-appointed experts, are shown up for what they are. I'm a great enjoyer of the Peanuts cartoons, and you know, with Snoopy. And there's a wonderful cartoon where Lucy, if you're familiar with Peanuts, then you're missing, if you're not familiar with Peanuts, you're missing something big, where Lucy decides that she is going to try and impress the assembled throng with her knowledge of music. Her particularly favourite piece is Bach's Toccata and Fugue in Asia Minor, she says. Much to the confusion of the true musician of the group, Schroeder, who looks very confused. And if you don't understand what is funny about Asia Minor, then have a word with Steve afterwards and he'll explain. See, it matters little when it comes to trivia, does it? Who cares about things like that? But when it comes to matters in life of life and death, real expertise matters a lot. And when it comes to the things about God, well, it has potentially eternal consequences. This morning we're going to see that Paul is a real expert, and he has come to shatter the illusion of the false experts who are running rife in this church in Corinth. But there's an awful lot of resonance in this chapter about, well, the kind of world that we live in and the experiences that we go through. So please don't park in your mind that this is all about Paul and Corinth. Actually, this is all about God and what we need to know about him now. And as we enter this chapter, and if you were with us last week, then you'll know that the previous chapter is all about Paul boasting, and you only need to cast your eye over it, and you'll see from verse 16 onwards of the previous chapter that it all is starting to feel a bit uncomfortable. The word boast keeps on coming up there. It's almost as though Paul is going through a list of boasts, isn't it? We've had, if again you just cast your eye across the previous part of the end of chapter 11, we've had his boast of Jewish ancestry, keeping up with the super apostles who are running rife in Corinth. We've had his boast of suffering, which is a slightly strange one. We've had his boast of humility, which sounds like a contradiction in terms. And it's not really very becoming, is it? I mean, of all the people that you would think shouldn't be boasting, I don't know what order of priority you would put on this. Maybe missionaries shouldn't boast, though we would give it, excuse them to do it, because after all, they live in the jungle all the time, don't they? And therefore they don't know what civilized society is like, apparently. And then there are our pastors shouldn't boast, and I'm sure someone would tell me that. And then elders likewise shouldn't boast. And by the time you get down to Sunday school kids, well, you might just expect it of them. Here is an apostle, and he's boasting his head off in a letter in the Bible. And it's not very becoming. And he recognizes it as we open up our chapter this morning, chapter 12 of 2 Corinthians, and he says in verse 1, I must keep on boasting, though there's nothing to be gained. Why must he keep on boasting? Why is he keeping on doing this? Why does he need to? Well, the answer is that he is meeting these self-appointed experts, what he refers to as so-called super apostles in chapter 11. He's meeting them blow for blow. And he's meeting them exactly where they're at. And the trouble is, you see, that the people in Corinth have been bamboozled by their boasting. He's speaking for those who have been bamboozled by boasting. The Corinthian church had largely been taken in by them. They were really impressed by these guys. They'd run riot in Corinth. They've been really impressive, apparently. Said lots of very impressive things. Remember, the great celebrities of this era, you can just read between the lines in 1 and 2 Corinthians, the great celebrities were the orators. And people would pay money to go and hear the orators. And these super apostles had rolled into town with lots of apparent credibility and just captured everyone's imagination. The Corinthians should have spotted the falsehood, but they didn't. And they should only have been impressed really by Jesus, but they were deeply impressed by the super apostles. Can I say just in passing this morning, it's an important warning for all of us not to be so taken with any kind of celebrity, be they pop idols or politicians or preachers, that we lose sight of the truth. God has given us an absolute standard by which we view the world. Correct goggles through which to see everything, and the goggles are the Bible. And if we legitimize a too high regard for anyone, particularly, can I say, in our church context, too high a regard for Christian leaders, that we automatically believe whatever they say, then immediately we ditch the Bible in favor of them. It's the road to ruin, always. I can think of examples where people do precisely that. I must just check what so-and-so says on this subject. It's something that's been said to me on more than one occasion. Well, to which my answer is always, I don't care what so-and-so says, what does the Bible say? That's what we should be measuring. Remember that this letter to the Corinthians is a what we've been calling a warts and all account of what living real life is like in the real world, but living it with God. And the Corinthians are having, frankly, a rough time, and Paul is having a rough time trying to help them. These Christians in Corinth had taken the great privilege of knowing the gospel of Christ and the freedom that that brought. Really, they'd taken it for granted. They knew what it was to have forgiveness before God. They knew what it was to exercise a relationship with Him. They had the great joy and delight of encouraging one another. Although there were factions, which Paul had condemned in his first letter, they knew what it was to have the hope of the gospel. And yet they were squandering that hope on admiration for the secular world's values. So Paul's task is to break the trance and help them see that their focus and attention should not be on great super apostles who can give them what they want, but that their focus and attention should be on Jesus who gives them what they need. And there is a disjunction between the two. If we're only ever given what we want, what we think we want, well, you can just imagine what the result will be. Imagine that my children came to the table every day and said, give us what we want. What would they want? Well, you can ask them afterwards. But it wouldn't be some of the good, nutritious food that we give them, I'm sure. Maybe there'd be a mixture, to be fair. And the next great battle of the boasts in Corinth is perhaps the most spectacular one. It certainly takes some reading, doesn't it? It's the battle of the boasts of visions and revelations from the Lord. In fact, the way Paul trips it off the tongue in verse 1, it's almost as if it's a kind of saying that's going round at the moment. After all, the super apostles have visions and revelations. How about you, Paul? Can you do that? We've never heard you talk about stuff like that. Well, listen to what happened to Paul. And I might just say that we know it's Paul, though he describes it in the third person, I know a man, and so on, because of the way he pitches it, and particularly because of verse 7, actually, where it's quite clear he's talking about himself. Let's read verse 2 onwards together. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether it was in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. I know that this man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know, but God knows. I know that this man was caught up to paradise. He heard inexpressible things that a man is not permitted to tell. You know, I don't know about you, but when I read that passage for the first time, I wanted to say, Paul, you've left me with more questions than you provided me with answers, actually. But that, in fact, is the whole point. Paul had had lots of other visions. If you read the New Testament through, he refers to them in various of his letters, but you only need to read the book of Acts to see some of them. There was the great Damascus Road experience where he had been converted in the first place. That was a vision, wasn't it? Most of us, I think none of us, would have shared anything like that. It was pretty amazing. In Acts 9, there was the man of Macedonia in Acts 16 calling him across to share the gospel. There was the reassurance in Corinth from Acts 18 that he should stay in this town some years before he wrote this letter and continue to minister amongst them, which he did for a year and a bit. But this one was different. This revelation that he's referring to is not recorded anywhere else. It happened 14 years before, and Paul, if you trace through, was converted maybe 20 years before. This incident is not recorded anywhere else. So it was some time after he became a Christian that this thing, whatever it was, took place. And bear in mind, he had spent in the intervening time over a year with these people in Corinth, Acts tells us, in Acts 18. So in other words, he had lived amongst them, ministered amongst them, shared the gospel with them, taught them what it is to know Jesus Christ as Lord and how that is exercised, and not once had he told them about this third heaven experience, whatever that means. You see, so special and sacred was the experience that he didn't really talk about it. And even now, he wants to draw the attention away from himself and so speaks in the third person. And he didn't tell them. Let's just unpack the experience that he had just a little. Firstly, what on earth does he mean by the third heaven? Most of us have got quite enough trouble trying to get our heads around one, let alone three. Well, let me tell you straight that whatever he's talking about, the other term he uses for it in verse 4 is paradise. It might not help you to know that in Jewish literature they sometimes spoke of three or seven or even ten heavens. How about that? And the bottom line is that because the Bible doesn't tell us, and the Bible contains only what we need to know about what we need to know, well, we can take it as read that we don't need to know. All right? Do you see my point? This is God's revelation of himself to us. That's what we find in the pages of the Bible. And he doesn't go to the trouble of explaining what the third heaven concept is about, so it's not something we should get terribly hung up about. Can I say, I have heard whole talks in other contexts on how many heavens there are and who's ruling each one. You have to have a big imagination to work that out, but you should ditch the lot and only be reading the Bible. If you're only reading the Bible, well, your imagination goes to pot, okay? So please don't try and make a doctrine out of this, because there isn't one there to be made. So what did he mean? How can we even have some concept? Because he's written it here, and therefore it's meant to indicate something to us. Well, I've said already that we don't know, but the context drives us, doesn't it? That he's saying he's reached a pinnacle. The concept of paradise is a pinnacle in whatever culture that you're in. This man, me, he says, visited the paradise, heaven, glory, wonder. The rule of understanding the Bible may be that if we're not told, we don't need to know, but you can easily get a sense of what he means in the context. Which means that it could be just picking up on the idea that throughout the Bible, there is a resonance, a symbolism, which indicates important points. And whenever they spoke of something being three or third, then there is an idea of completeness going on. Now that isn't as spooky as it sounds, is it? In our culture, we have phrases, terms of phrase that we indicate things through. So, for example, we would say that something is so simple that it's like 2 plus 2. Someone that was not mathematically trained may not have the foggiest idea what you're talking about and may go away worrying their head about 2. But we know that when someone says, oh, it's like that, an infant could get it. It just means that it's terribly simple. And we would use numbers in that regard, 2 plus 2 or 1 plus 1 or whatever. You know that throughout the Bible there are other great resonances. There were 12 tribes of Israel, weren't there? And there are 12 apostles. And in heaven, in this glorious great city of heaven, the New Jerusalem at the end of the Bible in Revelation, there are 12 gates. Well, you know that that kind of resonance is somewhat symbolic. I mean, it's, you don't need to have a great imagination to work that out. It's just kind of obvious. As you read the Bible, there are these kind of big numbers that come up. Seven is another one. I won't go through with that one. But three, perhaps, is the most obvious one. You know, that there is a Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You know, that Christ hung on the cross for 3 hours. That he was in the tomb 3 days and 3 nights. And it's always making the same point. Whenever you see this resonance of three, it's always making the same point. Complete, finished, kaput. Nothing more to come. And whatever else is going on here, Paul certainly wants them to get the idea that he's reached the top of the tree. I know a man, he says, who was caught up, taken up to the third heaven, to paradise, to the great place. And whether it was in the body or out of the body, well, he's reached the top. But again, let's unpack the other bit, the in the body or out of the body thing that he makes a great play on. In the Old Testament, there were two characters who went to heaven in the body. The first one you find really early on, a guy called Enoch. And we read in Genesis chapter 5, Enoch walked with God and then he was no more because God took him away. Enoch is regarded as a great hero of the faith, a great preacher of righteousness. Elijah is another one in 2 Kings chapter 2. Elijah, the great prophet of the Old Testament, of all the different prophets. Elijah was the great prophet of the Old Testament. And when it was his time to go to heaven, he didn't die and his body rot like ordinary people. We're not going to read it for sake of time, but you read in 2 Kings chapter 2 that he was taken. His assistant, Elisha, said, "My father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel." And God swept down with an angel company and swept Elijah away. Bodily, they went into heaven. Those men were great top-notch heroes of the faith. To have an experience even remotely like theirs would have put Paul at the very top of the tree in terms of spiritual experience. And of course, it would totally have trounced the super apostles. It doesn't matter who's walking around your church if someone as expert as that is interested in you, does it? And that's precisely what he's aiming to do. It's rather like being amongst people who are boasting they can swim and then being introduced to an Olympic gold medalist. Or being respected as a climber until compared to Sir Edmund Hillary, one of the first men to the top of Mount Everest. Can you see Paul's point? Paul's point is, if this stuff matters to you about qualifications, spiritual and all the rest of it, and this big one in this case, wisdom, revelation and visions, do you know what? I am absolutely at the top. But you don't hear me talking about it to get you to listen to me and the truth I'm sharing. Because I just don't think it's important. In fact, you may be bamboozled by boasting. But I think weakness is important. Verse 5. I will boast about a man like that if you want me to. But I'm not going to boast about myself. Except about my weakness. Verse 6. You see, even if I should choose to boast, I would not be a fool. Because I would be speaking the truth, but I refrain so that no one will think more of me than is warranted by what I do or say. Paul could have told them about all of this stuff a long time ago, but he didn't. He didn't want them to think he was a great preacher because of his experience. He didn't want them to listen to him agog because he was a so-called super spiritual guy. He really didn't. He wanted them to listen to truth for its own sake. Do you see? He wouldn't tell them, so no one will think of me more than is warranted by what I do or say. Do you remember I said last week that in our more reserved, if you were here last week, in our more reserved British culture, we don't normally boast so much as simply drop enough information so that we boast in the Winnie the Pooh way. Winnie the Pooh way? Winnie the Pooh, if you read A.A. Milne, always drops enough information in that they will think he is that sort of bear. That's what we do in our culture. Paul didn't even do that. He wasn't interested in doing that because he wasn't interested in their attention for Paul. He loved them desperately, and he wanted them to love him, but he wanted them more to give their attention to Jesus. And the only attention he wanted to get was more attention for Jesus. But the trouble is, having been so amazing in his experience, well, he sounds really rather superhuman, doesn't he? And there's a danger. Paul was an ordinary man like you and me. There was a great danger that he might have started to think of himself as slightly superhuman. Particularly when the low points came, he might just have kind of slunk away into a corner and rubbed his hands and said, you know what, I've been there. I know what it's like. I've seen the great thing. So what happened? Well, look at verse 7. To keep me from becoming conceited, because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. The great temptation for us, you see, when reading that, is to ask why on earth the Lord would have done such a thing. But look at the way Paul saw it. He spent his life suffering in some measure because of this. There is no doubt, you see, that the key understanding all of us need to grasp, and especially a Christian who wants to grow needs to grasp, the key understanding is a really, really big view of God. All of us need that if we are going to thrive as Christians. We need to think on those words. Our God is an awesome God. Awe means we may be awestruck by what he's like. He is bigger than any of us can conceive of, which is good. That understanding of a big view of God is why David was a man after God's own heart. That understanding of a big view of God casts light which illuminates every part of life. It affects your understanding of the world around you. It means, as I often say, you can look out on a world, look out on the world in the morning and not say, how will I live through such chaos? But you look out on a world in which you know your God reigns. But it also affects our attitude to the things that happen to our lives. So that wonderful comforting passage in Romans chapter 8, verse 28. All things work together for good to those who love God. Paul knew very well that, as the book of Job reminds us, Satan is not some great, equally matched enemy with God, as if there's some duality in the universe with God on one side and the devil on the other and Christians and the apostles somewhere in the middle kind of fighting a raging battle. No. God is God. Satan is a created being that can do nothing without God's authority, God allowing him to, as Job would pitch it in Job chapter 1 and 2. Read Job later on and you'll see. His intention, Satan's intention, is for our harm. And no doubt his intention with Paul was to take the glory and make Paul proud, so that Paul sits from time to time and says, wow, now I'm a real somebody. And if that didn't work, well, his intention was to hurt Paul in some way. This thorn in the flesh, we don't know what it was. It was some kind of physical ailment. Maybe it was the eye problem that he recounts in Galatians somewhere. And therefore to make Paul resentful. So Paul turned around to God and said, look, I've been through all this. How can you let me experience this? Why should I put up with this since I'm one of those great super apostles been to the third heaven? But no, Paul's great grasp of God's sovereignty meant that he could hold on tight and see what Satan intended for harm as being useful for his good. Can I say that in my experience, particularly of watching people struggle, The point at which to get a big view of the sovereignty of God is not in the middle of the struggle, but before you get to it. God is God. That was Paul's perspective. And therefore he could see what God was doing, even if he thought Satan was an agent of wrong. Satan meant it for harm, but Paul saw it for good. That doesn't mean that he enjoyed it. Far from it. Verse 8 tells us, three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. Paul was a great prayer. But verse 9, he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. People bamboozled by boasting need to learn that weakness is important and need to learn to rely on Jesus. I've said already, we don't know what the thorn in the flesh was. But again, that is a common Old Testament picture that always describes something which frustrates or causes trouble. Maybe it was Paul's eyes, I've said already, which seemed to have given him so much trouble. But the way he learned to cope with it was leaning on Jesus. The way he grasped God's sovereign hand in it was to recognize that God had a plan that he was fulfilling for Paul. And he learned to press on with his mission, even ministering to these troublesome Corinthian Christians who have hurt him and caused him so much grief by relying on Jesus' resources and not on his own. That absolutely is the pattern that runs through the Bible. Think back to some of the Bible stories that you know. So Joseph, the dreamer, remains faithful in the midst of terrible hardship. Jacob, his dad, alias Israel, who learned in the end not to scheme and finally understood what it was not to skip along on his 2 feet, but to lean on his staff after he wrestled with God and lost. Samson, relying on his own strength to fight and dishonors God and has to learn again that it is God's strength he relies on. David, who used a sling, not a sword, to kill Goliath, and so on, and so on. Do you know that's exactly the model we're seeing in tracing through the Easter story, starting this morning on Palm Sunday. Remember, Christ, who is fully God and fully man, must have appreciated in his flesh, he must have appreciated the adulation and praise of that celebrating crowd. He must have done. It was a wonderful experience, walking into Jerusalem with everyone singing. Fantastic. But within a week, they're calling for his execution. And the night before he dies, he prays, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. I might just say on Thursday evening, instead of a prayer meeting, we're going to be celebrating the Lord's Supper together, remembering what happened. Here is Jesus riding into Jerusalem on a donkey. You'd think a great warrior is going to ride in on a war horse, but he doesn't. Weakness, strength, held tight in weakness. Do you see the message? What is Paul telling them? These people who were entranced by super apostles. He's telling them to lean on Jesus, to look to Jesus, to give their attention to Jesus, to pray to Jesus, to rely on Jesus. Indeed, he says, verse 9, therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weakness, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. I've used this illustration before, but it bears me using it again. I remember some years ago being on an underground platform with one of my eldest children, but then toddler, standing in one of those terrible experiences where there's hundreds of people crowding onto the platform and squeezing and separating. If you've ever had it, it's terribly claustrophobic, and I don't normally suffer from claustrophobia. And just this horror that this toddler is about to be yanked from me. So I held his hand really tight. I said to him, don't let go, no matter what happens. But the truth is, it didn't matter how tightly he held on to me. I was not about to let him go without losing an arm. God does that to us. Do you see? When we recognize that we cannot hold on, is the point at which we begin to appreciate that he cannot let go. But it doesn't just count for them. See, in a world where people like to project an image of having things sorted, if I may use that expression, don't they? Don't we? Paul is happy to admit that he hasn't. But it doesn't matter, you see. Because he knows someone who has and can lean on him. If you're a Christian this morning, can I say that there is no need for you to project an image to the world around you that life is all sorted? It's not. Let's be honest, it's not. For any of us. People sometimes say to me after a Sunday morning, you know, my life is so tough and there are other people who just seem to be thriving. Can I tell you, I'm in the interesting position of recognizing that all of us have issues. All of us. But Jesus does not. He loves us more than we can begin to understand. So here's the question. Projection of image aside, here's the question that Paul wants to pose, the Holy Spirit wants us to grasp this morning. The question of who has your attention? Who have you been bamboozled by? Oh, I hope you're not bamboozled by anyone. Who are you persuaded by? Who are you looking to live life, warts and all? And who's going to help you? And who is the most secure? Well, the answer is that the Christ who died on a cross to save your soul is the one who has promised to be with you to take you to heaven if you'll trust him and love him and honor him. And who loves you and me more than we can begin to understand. He's the one that we should rely on and pray to and long for and glory in.